Talk given Sunday, 14th June 1981. Isolative, separative self-consciousness is at the root of all our trouble and misery in the world. See? Now, this discriminative consciousness is really the sinner in us. Because whatsoever tends to hurt, to destroy, to spoil the unity of the universe is the fundamental meaning of the word, the English word sin. That's what it means. Anything which spoils the unity of the universe. And our discriminative consciousness is constantly sinning by making us regard ourselves as separate from that which we experience in the world in which we live. This discriminative consciousness is the very devil in us, so to say. And we aspire, in our ignorance, to enter deeper and deeper states of consciousness in this sense, the discriminative consciousness, which divides us, which separates us. All those stages do play their part in the development of our religious life and so forth. That is perfectly true. But there must come the point when we have to override this discriminative activity. Now, when that happens, one is no longer discriminatively conscious. One is fully awake to the complete interrelationships between self and all that which we regarded as not self. When we awake to those relationships, then we become aware of the world, of the not self. We are no longer conscious of the not self, because consciousness functions in terms of analysis, in terms of splitting up things into bits and then sometimes mechanically putting them together. This does not bring about the relationship of perfect unification with the world in which we live. We characterize this and that and the other. But when we become aware in that sense, in the deep sense, then the characterization disappears. Now you find, for example, in the Buddhist teachings, the situation put this way, since I spoke of the Pali word vijnana, the Buddha also used this phrase, vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pabham or pahang. Discriminative consciousness which is characterless. That is to say, it doesn't become aware in terms of the different qualities which separate out that which we are aware of from ourselves. It's characterless. Anidassanam. Anantam. It is endless. Therefore, it never began. It was always there. You see how discriminative consciousness belongs to the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal, whereas a pure awareness belongs to the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. So there are no characteristics, there is neither beginning nor ending. Sabbato, everywhere, pahang meaning accessible, you can get at it, or you can enter into it, or pabham is the word sometimes used. Both words are used. Pabham means shining everywhere. Now you see, this puts a completely different complexion upon the whole situation. Now the Buddha used this long phrase, anidassanam anantam sabbato paham, and so on, you see. But the Upanishadic teachers, the Hindus, just used one single word to express all this, atma. So now, whenever you hear anybody saying, my Atma and my Atma or your Atma, disillusion him and said there is no such thing as my Atma or your Atma. You might as well talk of my eternity, my infinity, my immortality. There is no such thing at all. Obviously. How can the finite lay claim to the infinite? And supposing it could, which part of the infinite are you going to label Feroz Mehta or John Smith or this is his bit of infinity? You can't do it. It's an absurdity. But in this pure awareness, and the awareness is absolutely pure because the mind and the heart have been completely cleansed. And therefore the light of transcendence just shines through without being besmirched. This is a very important point to bear in mind. If we really appreciate this, then we shall be free of this all too human, mistaken striving to attain some spiritual status or perfection. We have to, we as individuals attain or achieve nothing whatsoever. All we can do is so to deal with ourselves that we have cleansed our whole psychophysical being of all that obstructs transcendence from functioning freely through us. That is all. And this is something quite different from striving to attain deep states of consciousness and so forth. In actual fact, although that is the sort of language which is used in the scriptures, you will find, particularly, for instance, in the Buddha's statements, that such and such a monk, he mentions particularly Sariputta by name, for instance. Sariputta never says or knows that I am entering this state of consciousness or I am entering out of this state of consciousness. Of course, the word consciousness is used there in the text, vijnana, you see. Now, that is extremely significant. It happens. And when it happens in that way, it means that the totality, transcendence itself, is functioning freely, unobstructedly, through this particular limited manifestation in the context of the finite. And this is one of the supreme ends, if one may say so, as far as our religious development is concerned. Because when that can happen, then you, the individual, are in complete relationship with the totality, with the wholeness. And you all are part of that wholeness, which means complete holiness. And in that, you have fulfilled the purpose of your existence. It's not your purpose, it's the purpose of transcendence. Thy will, O Lord, not mine. Then it gets fulfilled, not otherwise. If you or I try to formulate the will of the Lord for us, then we shall definitely go wrong, because every formulation inevitably gets made in terms of what I wish, I desire. I may desire something very exalted, etc., but there is always the I consciousness, the separative consciousness at work, which spoils the thing. You see? Therefore, all our aspiration has to be a completely selfless aspiration. All our effort has to be a completely selfless effort, which means we look to nothing for ourselves. And in actual fact, in our limited mortal life, there is nothing for ourselves as such. Something which we would evaluate, which we would consider worthwhile, and so forth. But on the other hand, because of that total unselfness and because of that complete absence of the intrusion of isolative consciousness into the whole situation, everything will be ours, so to say. Take no thought for the morrow. That's how one may understand that. That's at least one way of understanding it. You don't need to take thought for the morrow. If that spirit is working inside you, and the working of that spirit is something which is, it is our task to bring it about. And we bring it about not deliberately. If we do it, if we attempt it deliberately, it means that we have a vested interest in it. But the moment a vested interest comes in, we are in hell. So, let it happen. After all, after we were born, how did the body grow? Did we have any say in the matter? It growed up like Topsy. You see, the whole thing just happens, and we have to let it happen. We human beings, especially those who are very egoistic or very individualistic and believe in our individuality and so forth, we are interferers with the wonderful and sweet processes of life and providence. We are interferers with it all. And it's a great pity. But we don't see these things. Admittedly, it is not easy to see these things. It's difficult. Now, why do we interfere? What is there in us which sort of propels us to be what we are, interferers with the divine process of life? Consider the body itself. The body itself is endued with a pleasure-pain mechanism. If the body did not naturally have a pleasure-pain mechanism, we would soon perish. It's the pleasure-pain mechanism that tells the body, and this is purely physical, remember, it tells the body that this sensation won't hurt the body, won't kill the body. But that sensation would. So the body naturally avoids that, or tries to avoid that, and keeps along the path which is the sensible, normal path. So our pleasure-pain mechanism lies at the root of our bodily functioning. But the story doesn't end there. When we experience a pleasurable sensation, the brain stores it up in memory and demands more of it. We are all Oliver Twists. I want some more. I want some more. And craving arises. The repetition of a pleasurable sensation. And so, this is associated with the idea of happiness. But there is, with this psychical counterpart of, I like this sensation, I want some more, there is the experiencing of joy in it. Joy belongs to the psychical part in us. Pleasure belongs to the physical part in us. It's convenient to look at them that way, you see. Happiness for just the physical experience of pleasure, and joy for the psychical experience, which we call happiness and so on. Joy. All right. But then, we want so much of it that we say we want it eternally. We want eternal happiness, eternal joy. And we want it infinitely. Look deeply into the mind. The psyche, I mean, particularly. The psyche is never satisfied with enough. It always wants more and more. And far more than enough. And then it thinks of that as bliss. Now this is the great error. To think that an infinite intensity of happiness or joy is the real bliss. Far from it. It isn't anything of the sort. This is where the Sanskrit word, it's a Pali word also, ananda, is very helpful to understand the situation. Ananda does mean bliss, but not in the dictionary sense in the English language. It is associated with peace, perfect peace. It is associated with poise, with a state of inward equanimity and balance which is imperturbable. Now, as and when the mind and the heart are truly purified, we can go through terrible experiences and see the terrible things around us without having that inward poise and peace disturbed. It will remain there. It doesn't mean that we are repressing anything. Not at all. We are naturally poised. We are in harmony, in a state of inward harmony. And that inward harmony enables us to absorb any and every experience and situation through which we go in our day-to-day life. Of course, I'm talking in terms of the sort of perfect state. But we have to sort of have some sort of idea of the direction in which we are moving. It is this kind of perfect peace and poise and equanimity which grows with the purification of the mind and the heart through living the religious life. And this is the meaning of ananda. And this is bliss in the real sense. We know how joy and happiness, they belong to the mortal world. We have certain happy, pleasurable sensations and experiences, and we are in a joyful state, and then it finishes and it goes off, and then we are miserable again. We start with pleasure and excitement and all the rest of it, and we end up with misery. And if we experience misery as such, well, we begin with misery and continue with misery. And we often like to hold on to our misery because it's a marvelous subject for tea time conversation. So now, this way, we can realize that the true fulfillment is associated with bliss, which goes right beyond all duality and all ambivalence. If we see this, then, if we really see this, then we would cease to pursue all sorts of sensational excitements and delights and so forth, knowing that they belong to the ephemeral, knowing that they just come, they just go. But if one is in the state of poise and peace inwardly, then one takes in one's stride whatsoever comes. The happy, the joyful will come, the painful, the miserable will also come. But we shall just take it all in our stride. And the psyche will be able to absorb that, absorb it and transmute it. The transmutation is a transmutation of that which comes to us as sensation into the state of perfect harmony, of balance. This is, of course, it's easy to talk about these things. Perhaps it's not so easy also to express these things. One has to experience a lot and have sufficient insight to be able to present it at all. And it's difficult, admittedly. But something like this does happen, you see. So, the question arises then, how does one bring about this purification? What is our instrument of salvation? Our instrument of salvation is our power of attentiveness. I have said this dozens of times already, but it's the sort of thing that bears repetition until it is a realized fact. And until it is a realized fact, it has to be repeated again and again. We learn a certain amount by constant repetition, don't we? Just like a child learns by repeating. Now, this power of attentiveness. We may say, yes, but I do pay attention to everything I see, I hear, touch or taste or smell or think or feel or remember. I do pay attention to it. Do we? How do we pay attention to it? If you watch the process in the brain very carefully, you will see that the brain is talking back all the time at whatsoever is presented to it through the avenues of the senses. You come into this room, we'll say, and you see that portrait of me, and you say, oh, what an extraordinary portrait. But I don't like it, I don't like it. That nose is crooked, that mouth is this. Perhaps the eyes are all right, but you see, the brain is constantly talking back, either approving or disapproving, and so forth. We never actually just look. Just look, pure looking. That's not done. Take the reactions of the parent to the new infant that has come along. The most wonderful babe in the world, nothing like it, perfect beauty. Take the reactions of the somewhat lemony next door but one neighbor. Oh, that, look at that kid. Isn't it awful? Watch. But that's what we all do, don't we? And we do the same with what we hear, with what we touch, or smell, or taste, etc. Our discriminative activity is not a pure discernment of what is helpful or what is harmful. Take food, for instance. Look at the way people, human beings behave towards food and the whole question of food. Why we like it, why we dislike it, why we want it just thus or just thus, and so forth and so on. You see? So that we say we pay attention, but when we pay attention like this, with constant reaction for or against, approving or disapproving, praising or blaming, then we are not attentive. Pure attentiveness means really to unite your own awareness with the actual fact as it is, by not talking back at the sense impressions which you receive. When one attends that way, what happens? There is a state of unity released between yourself and the experience or object or whatever is happening. There is a sense of unity, and in that sense of unity, that all-pervading unity, there is a real relationship of love, of wisdom, of goodness and truth and beauty. In other words, we have ceased to be a self separate from the world in which we live. We have ceased to sin, to hurt or spoil the unity of the universe. Mind you, all this is frightfully difficult, admittedly, because the physical body, which is derived from a primordial animal ancestor, has all those animal drives and urges in it. And furthermore, it has all the accumulated effect of the development of the human race through the ages. And the development of the history of the human race has not all the time been milk and honey, has it? It has been very poisonous, often and often, all too often. Well, look at our present world, what it is. Look at the terrible things that happen. Deliberately done by so many who are the unfortunate instruments of evil. So there we are. Now, paying attention. Where evil and terrible things are concerned, if we attend, therefore, without praising, without blaming, but really understanding that this thing has been done or this thing is happening because such and such are the factors at play which have resulted in this particular thing, in this particular place, at this particular moment of time. When we understand and see things that way, in our own awareness, there is a remarkable healing power released. In that state of unity, that inward, our inward poise, which enables that unity to come about, it has a tremendous healing power, a whole-making power. We can never be conscious of it. Don't try to be conscious of it. Don't inquire whether it is working or not or anything like that, because that will spoil the working of something which belongs to the transcendent and not to me, the person. If one can live, truly live by thy will, O Lord, not mine, then it is the Lord who is the doer all the time. You find that brought out remarkably well in the Bhagavad Gita. Sri Krishna tells Arjuna, be unconcerned with the results. Thy business is with the action only. Do all, perform all action as unto me. And he's speaking as the Lord of the universe, the incarnate God in India. Right? And that means that he is the doer, he is also the reaper. He is the sower, he is the reaper. Uses you or me as the instrument only for doing the sowing and apparently doing the reaping. So if we see things that way, then we understand the true significance of attentiveness as a pure human being. We have to allow ourselves to grow into our true and full humanity. You know how people always say, oh, it is human to err, it is human to make mistakes and so forth. It is human to be faulty, to be unvirtuous and all that. That's all nonsense. It isn't at all human, it's subhuman. It is human to be fully virtuous. Virtue means the strength, the power of the psyche in its healthy, whole, holy condition. That is virtue. Virtus. Vir, the Latin vir means a man, the human being as such. And so if we see these things sufficiently intensely, and we don't see the thing sufficiently intensely, if we want to get hold of the idea and cling on to it. Don't cling on to it as an idea. An idea, a thought, by itself is impotent. It is this awakening in your inner consciousness, in your innermost awareness of the real nature of this power, so to say, which is mind, the power of mind, the real power of thought, which has no relationship with particular human desire and so forth, directed towards a personal end or anything like that, you see. Then this power comes into play, it works, and it brings about the full human fulfillment. And that is the real state of bliss, that state. You will find that when that transformation, that transmutation takes place inside, and one lives in full awareness of everything, then what we call our difficult circumstances and all that, they undergo change in the most extraordinary way. They just change. Things begin to come right. Not because I tried to bring them, to make them right, because I allowed it to happen. Rightness, perfection is inherent in all manifestation, in the entire universe. You look at the way how perfection is manifest in the plant kingdom, in the animal kingdom. Take the mineral kingdom. You get the perfect gem. It has come to fruition. Look at the roses in the garden just these last few days. How wonderfully they have come out. Wonderful perfume, wonderful shape, wonderful color. To delight the soul. Now, when one can experience that in this blissful state, which belongs to the transcendent, then true happiness and true joy, the fleeting things in the temporal and mortal world, also come your way. But you have to learn to take both in your stride.